Let's make sure that everybody has a copy of the material. Lesson 13, The Crucifixion of Christ. Okay? Oh, yeah.
After class, we'll make sure that we get lesson 14 passed out. So. Anybody else? Okay? Lesson 13. Okay. I'll leave a couple just in the back. When it's about the crucifixion, all the information in the Bible is important. The reasons for that vary. But when we think about the crucifixion of Christ, this is really the centerpiece of the Bible. I mean, it's the means by which God has made adequate, full, proper, just provisions for the redemption of people from the problem of sin. And that's why I think in the first line of lesson 13, the writer says the most important event in the history of the world was the crucifixion. That is right. You have all kinds of indications of that in the Old Testament. There are some statements which might be regarded as direct statements pointing to that. It is indicated by type. That is, there are some events which point forward to the crucifixion. We've talked about the Passover lamb, the smearing of blood. And one of the things that we've not talked about, I didn't mention this as we've been going through the book of Exodus. But let me just toss this out since we're thinking about the crucifixion of Christ. When you go back and you look at the book of Exodus, time for the Passover lamb to be sacrificed. How was that blood put on the doorpost?
Hyssop.
Okay, so you've got a brush, basically. And, you know, just, you know, if you're brushing up something, anybody ever touch up some paint? Most of us have. Painter from several years ago showed me what I think is a pretty cool trick. He said you can put a little water on your brush and then put paint on there, and it really feathers it in pretty well. So pick that up in Bible class as a free tip if you like. But if you're going to just do a little brushing up, you know, you might have a little spot in the wall, and you go over there and get the water in the brush, and you just feather it in, and, you know, maybe it's about the size of a dime. Is that what they did with the Passover? No. What'd they do? It's all over the doorpost. Now, that's an interesting detail. If there just needed to be blood on the doorpost, could they have put, you know, about as much as the end of your little finger? I mean, if God hadn't legislated. I mean, they could have. But the teaching was, you go ahead and you cover that outer door frame with blood. There had to be a reason for that. As you look at the Bible, and especially as you think about this lesson, I think that we can at least suggest a reason why that might have been covered with blood. Anybody want to take a stab at why that might have been?
It's through the blood. You go through the blood.
Yeah. I think, you know, that was as far as the type. You know, there's this passing through, and it's not just a little dot here. It's not just a little dot there. But I think that's reason one. Anybody want to take a second shot at a reason? Well, okay. There again, I'm going to tie that in with the first one. You know, you've got this. It's definitely blood. But think about Jesus' crucifixion. Was it, if you will, a bloody event for the Lord? What happens before he goes to the cross? All right, he's bleeding. You know, somebody starts jabbing some thorns into your head, you're probably going to bleed. And when you think about the stripes that were inflicted on the Lord's back, we've talked at various times how Peter in the Greek text uses a singular word for stripe there. It was just like it was one massive wound. You couldn't separate the stripes. It's a lot of blood. And then when you get him out on the cross, the piercing of the hands and feet, you would expect blood there. You think about the side of Jesus being pierced, you know, blood and water come out from that. And I can see a connection, a very easy connection, between what you have back there with the Passover lamb and that blood covering the doorpost and all the blood associated with Christ. So I can't say for 100% certainty, but it certainly seems to me that back there with that first Passover and the lambs being sacrificed, it was a way of saying something else is coming down the road. Now, that's certainly true because 1 Corinthians 5 says Christ is our Passover. And what was coming was exactly what we was describing. You know, there's going to be this way, this blood-covered way that we sometimes think about. And it's also going to be a way that is going to be very bloody as far as all the things involved with sacrifice. So very, very important event, not only from the standpoint of the world's history, but also from the standpoint of the Scriptures. You also see in that first full paragraph, in short, he says approximately one-third of the four Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, deal with the last week of Jesus' life. I'm not sure that a lot of people realize that. They think, well, there's a lot of information in there about Jesus' birth, and there's some information in there. And there's a lot of information about his teaching, and there's a lot of information about his ministry, the places where he went, and all that kind of stuff. And those things are true. But really, when you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you boil it down and you say, how much do we have as far as information, the percentage related to this topic and this topic, the last week of Jesus' life, basically a third of the information of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. So that's one more way of God saying to people, look, all the stuff about Jesus is important, but his death is really the focal point. And that's why when Paul, for example, came to the Corinthians, he said, I came preaching what? Christ and him crucified, talking about this fellow who was killed, put to death, the Son of God, but he was raised from the dead. Thinking about Jesus last week. Again, want to make sure everybody's got a copy of the material. If you don't, there are a couple of lessons. Okay. I've also got a couple up here, so it'd be a little bit easier to follow along if we're all literally on the same page. Under that first full paragraph that says the last week, he notes for some time Jesus had warned the 12 that he would be soon leaving them. We've talked about this at various times on the Wednesday night class. Jesus, thinking back to Matthew 16 where he told Peter, that was where Peter confessed him as the Son of God, and Jesus said, I've got to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer many things. I'm going to die. So well over a year before Jesus went to Jerusalem, he's warning his disciples, he's preparing them for the fact that he has a mission. It's not a typical mission. He's come not to just live, he's actually come to die and then be raised from the dead. And by the time that we're talking about now in the Wednesday night class, that is, the Lord was going to need to depart. He promised a comforter, and they still didn't understand all the things that they needed to know. There were pieces of information about the kingdom that they still didn't understand, like some people today. They were thinking in terms of a material kingdom, where he had in mind a spiritual kingdom that was going to last and last, rather than the kind of earthly kingdom that may be in place for less than a year, maybe a few generations. We have Jesus during that triumphal entry week. He's going into Jerusalem. We have studied about that not all that long ago. He was on the colt of an ass. The people spread the branches. And what were they saying? Hosanna. You know, they were praising God. They were honoring God, giving, you know, the Lord a pretty nice degree of praise. But they still didn't understand a lot of things. And as I said, that's within his last week. You've got him less than a week out before the crucifixion. Jesus, during that last week, he also goes into the temple. He's trying to teach people. And you find, I think, people with good intentions doing the same thing today. You have, for example, a parent that's dying. Children come in, maybe they're young, maybe they are older kids, adults, and they're still not on the right road. What will that older parent, that older adult do? Final hours, final days, final breath in the body. Trying to teach. Trying to instruct. Trying to correct. Trying to warn. And there have been some people, literally, it was their dying breath saying, remember. Do. Don't forget. Change things. Those kinds of things. And they did. Jesus did the same kind of thing. Alright, then as we look at Jesus' crucifixion, we also have some information about Judas Iscariot. We're talking about him some as well on Wednesday evenings, and he, of course, was helping fulfill God's will, God's plans for redemption, and he acted of his own accord. He had his own free will, and yet those things, even though Satan was using him, God was able to turn all those events around for the benefit of all people. We've talked about his bargain that was struck for 30 pieces of silver. This is something that is prophesied in the Old Testament. Just amazing that God would have been able to... It's not amazing that he was able to. It's amazing that we have that information as far as showing us the power of God, that he predicted what was going to be done, the price that was going to be paid, the fact that it was going to come from a friend, and all those things. And during this time, as we've again talked about on Wednesday nights recently, the Passover Supper, you have that night, Jesus is meeting with the apostles. We've talked about the fact that as Jesus described that, he said, I not only desired, I greatly desired. I've really been looking forward to this time to spend this with you. Well, one of the reasons for that was the Lord knew that he was going to die, and there was going to be that new institution, new covenant, new testament was going to be instituted, and he said, I'm going to drink it new with you, that is the Lord's Supper, where? In my Father's kingdom. Not in heaven, but he was going to drink it with them, share it with them, where?
In the kingdom.
All right, in the kingdom, on earth, and the church. So he's not literally there, partaking of the Lord's Supper with us, but he's present. So when we honor him in worship, when we come together on days such as this, that promise continues to be fulfilled. Now, they still had some issues. So as we talked about maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, some information from John chapter 13, the washing of the feet. We went through that and showed that they needed to realize that they had to be servants, and that was Jesus' way to teach them that as far as an illustration. He talked to them about that, but this was an illustration. And we're now in the midst of this in our Wednesday night class. We covered John 14, verses 1 through 3 last Wednesday, where Jesus said, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going to go and prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'm going to come back. And there, you know, we can be together." We looked at that from the standpoint of the church. And Jesus is going to, as those chapters unfold, John chapter 14, he's going to talk about keeping his commandments. That's something that we do here on the earth. And then in John 15, he's going to give the branches and the vine illustration. We're connected. Certainly we'll be connected in eternity, God and his people. But in this life, through the church, Jesus and his people are tied together. And the church needs some guidance. So in John chapter 16, the Lord said, "I've got to leave. But am I going to leave you like an orphan? Am I going to abandon you? No, I'm going to send you another. I'm going to send you the Holy Spirit. And he's going to guide you into all truth." Well, if you have all truth, and you have people who are committed to that truth, that more than likely would lead to what? Or could lead to unity, wouldn't it? So in John 17, what do you find? Jesus prays for unity. So it's one big section related to things associated with the church just prior to Jesus' death. So he mentions the institution of the Lord's Supper, Matthew 26, verses 26 to 28. And again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we've covered the material in the Wednesday class very thoroughly. There's some people who, as they look at the bread, the fruit of the vine, they get the idea that Jesus was speaking literally, that it was actually his body, and that he was saying, "This is my blood." Well, there's some problems with that. The Bible doesn't allow people to ingest blood. Acts 15, verse 20 is going to be one of the passages, I believe, where that is forbidden. And you can find some other verses as well. So you have Jesus concluding the supper. There was the hymn that was sung. We talked about that in one of our last classes as well. Then it's time for Jesus to go out into the area of Gethsemane, that place of suffering, like an olive press. It felt like Jesus was going to be squeezed during that process of death, and that's exactly what happened. So they crossed the Brook of Kidron. They reached the Garden of Gethsemane, and there you find Jesus not only praying, but praying very intensely. The writer rightly says he earnestly entreated the Father to let the cup of suffering pass from him if it were God's will. This was, we might say, a temptation for Jesus. He was subject to temptation, and this was. It's just like things today. Person's facing a hospital stay, or person's facing some incredible sickness, or they're going to have to go through some painful experience. They're going to have to see something awful happen to the child, and their thinking is, we don't want to go through that. And for an immature Christian, the prayer probably is going to be what? God, free me from that. I don't want to go through that experience. But as the years go by and people get a little more gray in the hair and think about things maybe from a more biblical standpoint, you might find that that prayer changes from "God, keep me from that" to, "Yeah, I hope I can avoid this. But God, if that's not the way, help me through this. I know that you can help me through this. I know that I can manage this, and I need your aid." So that is a mark of spiritual maturity, and Jesus certainly demonstrated that when it came to the cross. The writer continues. He says, if it was not God's will that he escaped the suffering from the cross, then, again, Jesus was willing to endure that, and that's exactly what he did. Jesus was in a state of agony. His sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood. And there are some medical folks, some others who are not medical folks, who think that that may have been a medical condition. Whatever it was, medical condition or not, that's what Jesus experienced, and it was one more indication of just how trying and traumatic this was. He returned to the place where the disciples were. He had left them. He went a short distance from them. And what's he find? All right. Now, if they deserted him, that would have been bad. I'm not saying the sleeping was good, but I mean, I suppose it could have been worse if they just decided, well, we're just going to leave. I don't think there's any indication that they wanted to do that, but people will sometimes disappoint us.
You know, we come home and maybe it's a mate, maybe it's a child. I'm going to stay up for you. We're going to do something when I get home. What do you find? You know, they're conked out. So we've had, to some degree, that same kind of experience. Maybe depended on somebody, and then they were not there when we were needing them. And that is, as the writer says, the very time he needed them the most. Three times Jesus prayed in this intense way, and then, again, it's finally time to leave the garden. Well, you would think that, okay, things are going to be looking up, but what happens at that point? There's some folks that show up. They've got... All right, we've got a mob. Judas shows up. They've got, you know, the torches, the staves and clubs and so forth. And they have come for the Lord. Judas had made that bargain, and he fulfilled what he had promised. Later had some regret. Now, he didn't repent in the sense that the Bible uses that word, but he did have some remorse, but not enough to go ahead and shut this activity down. Then you have Peter. The writer says it was a flash of courage. Maybe that's true. Not quite sure what motivated Peter. Maybe it was just love for the Lord. You do find that Peter's a little impetuous. Remember at the Transfiguration, doesn't quite know what to do. So, you know, let's build some little shelters here. Well, that wasn't quite the right thing to do. But you do have to at least, I think, appreciate Peter from the fact that he didn't run. You know, whether he felt threatened or not, he didn't try to flee from what the Bible indicates. Takes off the sword he has, and what's he do with it? Cuts off the ear of Malchus. Now, when you think about this, and we talked about this in a class as well not all that long ago, Peter was from a fishing background. And if you deal with a fella, and it's not always going to be this way, there would be exceptions on both sides of the fence. But if you have a fella who's an outside worker, you know, you can have a bricklayer, or you can have someone who's a construction worker, and they feel like there's a threat, you think you might have a little bit of a fight in the hands. A construction worker might say, hey, if you're messing with me, if you're messing with somebody I love, you're messing with, you know, this lady who's defenseless, those kinds of things, he just might pick up a hammer or a crowbar and try to give you a whack. Now, if you have somebody who's an office worker, you know, again, the circumstances may vary. They may be a little less inclined, something like that, to come after you. But, you know, you start messing with somebody who, you know, using the muscles on a regular basis and, you know, maybe a pretty hardy guy, you might be biting off a little more than you're expecting. And that could have been a very interesting experience. But Jesus was able to shut things down, heal Malchus's ear, and then things proceed. He says in the next paragraph the what?
Trail.
I'm not sure if he meant trail or trial. There was a little bit of a trail, but there was also multiple trials for Jesus. So I don't know what was in the author's mind, but maybe that was a typo. All right, he did get the right, word right in the next line. He says, the trial of Christ was both irregular and illegal by judicial standards. I have a book, and it's not the only one. There have not been many, to my knowledge, that were written on this, but at least a couple of attorneys have decided to, from a legal standpoint, talk about the trial of Jesus. And maybe lawyers and preachers are a little similar, in that they can get really wordy. They just love to hear themselves talk, I think, or just love to see what they write. But anyway, this book I have as far as the trial of Jesus, it's like that. Now imagine somebody talking about, with just the limited information that we have about Jesus, the trial, and looking at it from a book that's about 2 inches thick. I mean, I first saw that and I bought it used, and I still haven't been able to read through the whole thing. But I have looked at it at various times. But you look at Jesus, there were 6 stages to the Lord's trial. Some Jewish, some Roman. The writer highlights them here under the trail heading. He says, first taken to Annas, the father-in-law of the Jewish high priest Caiaphas. With a high priest, you find sometimes that it was not really a dual position, but, you know, kind of like today. People will sometimes overshadow a position after somebody's left it for a little bit, and that kind of happened sometimes with the Jewish high priest. And then you have, after the time with Annas, runs over to Caiaphas, and Caiaphas pronounces him worthy of death. It's the time where, you know, Peter is outside. He's denying Jesus. The Lord had predicted that the cock was going to crow, and before that, you know, Peter was going to deny Jesus 3 times, and those 3 denials did occur within that time period. Then you've also got Peter repenting himself. Sunrise comes. Again, the stuff is taking place at night. That was one of the illegal things. We recognize that same principle today. You know, if you're going to be picked up for a charge,
Police come out, they grab you, they handcuff you. Probably the first thing that goes through your mind is going to be what?
What's
going to
happen?
Well, okay, but even I think that's probably going to be foremost in the mind, but maybe even something even before that. Well, but even before that, isn't there the question why? Why are you arresting me? I mean, now you might suspect, you might know why they're arresting you, but until they actually come out and say the charge is this or that, you're being picked up for this thing or that thing, the question is why? Now, again, I want to know what's going to happen to me and am I going to go to jail and all those other things, but tell me why you have come out and you've cuffed me and why you're putting me in the police car. We expect a certain process to unfold. And after we're handcuffed, I have not had that experience, but after we're handcuffed, after we're arrested, our general knowledge of the legal system would incline us to think there are going to be some other things that are required by the law, and these are going to be legal or lawful steps. What would some of those other things be?
Know your rights.
All right. You're going to be given the fact that, you do have some rights, and those rights need to be expected. I'm not going to mention this in the morning sermon today or any other lesson that I have intended, but there is a religious group that I'm going to talk about this morning. I didn't know this until reading recently, and the religious group believes that once you die, if you are among the unsaved, angels will pick you up, take you to the place of punishment. But before you get to the place of punishment, they're going to whack you around a little while. They bop you around on the face a little bit and chastise your back to kind of give you a foretaste of what's going to come. Now, to me, that doesn't sound very kind or very just. But, think about that. If you're dealing with the cops, you don't expect them to slap you around a little bit, do you? You expect, okay, you may pick me up, you may charge me, but still, you don't have the right to beat me up. I mean, that's illegal. You just don't have the authority for that. Take me down to a processing center, whether that's the jail or wherever, holding area where that happens to be, and then, again, I get my phone call, and there's some other typical things. But when you look at Jesus, and if you were looking at this from a lawyer standpoint, there were several things that were done that were simply not legal. And it's not just one or two. In fact, you could preach a couple sermons on that, of all the things that were done that were not in accordance with the law. And one of those things was doing it at night. The Bible talks about, the nighttime as being a time where a lot of people, it's in contrast to the light, a time where a lot of people want to do what's evil. Well, there was a reason that Jesus was taken during this time. All right, then going back to our lesson, you've got him going over to Pilate, over to Herod, and then going back to Pilate. Pilate, ruler, and when you deal with rulers, you usually have politics mixed in there in some ways, so he tries to find a way to release the Lord. That doesn't work out very well. Washing the hands, I'm free from the guilt of this man. And, let's just beat him and free him. But politicians, even though they've got power, what's one of the things that can motivate them to do something they don't want to do? All right. The public, the crowd. And even if it's a dictator, you get enough people that are in uproar, you just don't want to go out and kill 90% of your countrymen. So sometimes you have to make some kind of deal. Maybe you have to go back and rethink things. And that's really what Pilate had to do. So Jesus ends up being turned over to soldiers. They mock him, whip him, and then finally he goes off to be crucified. The crucifixion, the Lord was crucified about 9. Some people try to put the crucifixion on a day other than Friday. To me, that seems to be very difficult for a number of reasons. So I do accept a crucifixion on Friday about 9. Some say, as the writer says, about Thursday is a day that some claim, but I don't think that's right. Golgotha, Calvary, we're familiar with that. We've probably heard over the years that the meaning of that is skull. Don't know exactly where that is. I mean, we can come probably reasonably close to the illustration or the place where that was and illustrate it. People try to do that, but again, in Jerusalem, people say, well, this is that, and sometimes that's maybe right and sometimes maybe not. We do have an inscription over the Lord's cross above him, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Kind of an odd thing to say, and surely intended for jest, but it really was true. King of the Jews and King of everybody else. On each side, they crucified a thief to show their contempt for him. Bad enough in that day and time to crucify somebody. I mean, that was just the worst way to put somebody to death. But there are some things that can be done if a person is going to be shamed. We've seen that in some recent cases. It doesn't always work very well. But over the last year, you may have seen some cases in the news. The judge, in a particular case, decided to shame a person. So he has them, just as you might go down the street and you see somebody wearing a billboard for a pizza or pawn shop, advertising something. Well, the judge says, you got to wear a sign. I'm a thief, or I am a, just fill in the blank. And they've got to parade around in public for a little while to kind of publicly shame them. Well, that's not anything new. It's been done in different forms in different places for a long, long time. It was a very dark hour as far as the world's history, and yet from that darkness, God brought the most marvelous light. You do have seven sayings of Jesus on the cross. We'll try to look at those this morning, and he gives them here, coming back to them in a little bit, and then you move from there, of course, to the body of Jesus, getting it, preparing it for burial, putting it in the tomb. And then, of course, you have the lady showing up, and then guard that was placed, but that wasn't sufficient to prevent Jesus from being raised from the dead. Then the author unknown, before we look at the questions, he said, here's a young man who was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30, and then for 3 years he became an itinerant preacher. Never wrote a book, never held an office, never owned a home, never had a family, never went to college, never, to our knowledge, put his foot inside a big city. I mean, Jerusalem was not exactly small, but not a big city in the sense that we would think of in our day and time. Never traveled more than a couple hundred miles from the place where he was born, and never did the things that we would normally associated with greatness. No credentials as far as advanced degrees, but himself. He was, during the time that he was a young man, the tide of public opinion turned against him. Friends ran away, turned over to his enemies. The mock trial that we talked about, nailed to a cross, and then you have that being done in between two thieves. Dying as he was coming to the end of his life, executioners gambled for the only pieces of property he had on earth, and that, of course, was his coat. When he was dead, put into a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. So you would look at that kind of life, I think, those facts, and think, that fella, he's going to fade into the annals of history, and nothing's going to ever be significant or important about him. Well, there have been about 20 centuries that have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. And again, people hate him sometimes. People say, I don't believe in him. But history has kept the name of Jesus and his word alive for a long, long time. He says, I'm far within the mark when I say that all the armies that ever marched, and all the navies that were ever built, and all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man upon this earth as has that one solitary life. And that is exactly right. Jesus, as we intend to study from the next Wednesday class, he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And his word has done great things. Anything that you want to add or ask as far as the textual material? Okay, let's go through the questions quickly. Who betrayed the Lord with a kiss? Okay, we should have all gotten that one right. Judas. To whom did Jesus commit the care of his mother? John. And the father-in-law of the high priest? Annas. Caiaphas was the high priest who denied that he knew Jesus. Peter, who knew the Lord was innocent but gave consent to crucify him. Pilate, coward in many ways. Who had jurisdiction over Galilee? Herod. And then in whose tomb was the Lord buried? Joseph of Arimathea. True or false? Pilate asked Jesus if he was king of the Jews. True. So, it was a good question. Pilate then said, there is no doubt the man is guilty. False. True or false? Pilate sent Jesus to Herod because he was from Galilee, over which Herod had jurisdiction. True. We see that same kind of thing today, don't we? Teresa and I don't know for sure, but the Tony Stewart case, we talked about that a little bit, the prosecutor. Let's call a grand jury. Now, maybe that was in accordance with the law, but that sure made that guy's life a little easier, didn't it? You got an elected office. Well, let's let a grand jury. I'm just going to free myself. Now, maybe that wasn't the motivation. Maybe that was a small part of it. But politicians are good, if they can, at passing the buck. Herod was glad to see Jesus. Number four. True. Herod told the soldiers not to mock the Lord. False. Pilate sending Jesus to Herod made them enemies. Seven. After Jesus was sent back to Pilate, Pilate said that he would chastise the Lord and release him. It's true. Eight. Since it was the custom to release a man at the feast, the people asked that Barabbas be released. It's true, yes. Number 9, against Christ they cried, shoot him, shoot him. Now, in today's world, I believe there are some people that, oh yeah, that was what they said. You know, shoot him, shoot him. They might not be thinking of a gun, maybe a bow and arrow, but they did not say shoot him, shoot him. So, want to test somebody's Bible knowledge? I had a friend the other day say, you know, this would be Facebook friends, some preacher from somewhere, and I said, sure. And he said, oh, up there in the land of Goshen. And I said, yeah, we find that in the Bible. And I said, I think I've said this publicly, but I said, I always know when somebody doesn't have much Bible knowledge. Yeah, up there in Goshen, Indiana. Mm-hmm. So if you get that too, sometimes you talk to somebody and, oh, you live in Goshen. Uh-huh, yeah. I know that you read the Bible a bit. Number 10, Pilate finally gave in and agreed to let them do to Jesus as they wanted. True. All right, I thirst.
John 19:28. Good. Father, forgive them. All right, Luke 23, and it's finished.
John 19:30.
Very good. Woman, behold thy son. And then today thou shalt be with me in paradise. Mm-hmm. Only got a couple left. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Yep, that's verse 46 and Luke 23. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Mark 15:34. Question that's not on here. When you think about crucifixion, Jesus' crucifixion, would you say you find more information about it in the New Testament or the Old? Yeah, the crucifixion of Christ. Would you find, you think, more information about it in the New Testament or more information about it in the Old? Well, let's take a survey. That way nobody's put on the spot.
Wait a minute. Define that question. In what terms of information?
I'm thinking in basically the broadest possible terms.
Oh.
That is a good question. So, yeah, before you raise your hand, you might want to know that. All right, very broad terms, things that can be connected to the cross of Christ somehow. More in the old, more in the new. Who votes for the new? Okay, about 6 maybe. Who votes for the old? Okay. I think there's some people that don't want to vote. But anyway, the answer would be the old. The answer would be the old. You go back, for example, to Psalm 22 and find some information in there about Christ, things... you know, the mockery and so forth. So it's a question that we don't often think about, but really, of the two, you might say that in the new, it's a lot more explicit and direct. You know, the crown of thorns and all the things that were associated with that. But it's true that in the Old Testament, you do have more. 3 times in the New Testament, we have some information as far as a specific reference to the cross of Christ. You see that in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 17. Paul talks about the cross of Christ early in the book. Also, the death of Jesus, as we mentioned, 1 Corinthians 15. Galatians 6:12 also specifically refers to the cross of Christ in Philippians 3, verse 18. But even though you do have some specific references, I think sometimes in our minds, we become so familiar with something. It's just like today. You find, for example, some expressions that even though we may not... How long has it been since we've seen the Wendy's Where's the Beef commercial? Anybody seen that in the last 5 years? I can't remember seeing it within at least the last 10. I think somebody put it on the internet way back when. But, you know, even though that's not something that is way out there, you know, we got exposed to it and it just kind of sticks in the head. And I think we do that with the New Testament verses as well. It's not that we've got so many passages to talk about it. We've just allowed that to become so ingrained in our minds, which is good, that we might think that that's almost on every other page of the New Testament, but that's really not right when it comes to the cross of Christ. I do want to, as I said, look at the 7 sayings. We've got some other things here that we can tie in as well. Let's have those read. We'll get the first 3 lined up and then make a quick point about each one. We will start with Luke 23, verse 34. All right, that'll be Steve, Luke 23, 34. Number 2, we'll take it from John 19, 26 and 27. John 19, 26 and 27. That'll be Don. And number 3 will also come from Luke 23. This will be Luke 23, verse 43. Luke 23. All right, Maxine. Luke 23, verse 43. All right, Luke 23, verse 34. Steve, we'll start with you.
Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots.
Okay. Now, whole sermons have been preached on the 7 things. Sometimes they deal with all 7 in one lesson. Sometimes they'll say, we're going to deal with all 7 in 7 different lessons or split them up, you know, 3 and 4 or 4 and 3, those kinds of things. But let's just make a couple of quick observations about these. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What observation, as far as a quick point, would you make about that saying? What's Jesus concerned about? What's he focused on? What's he thinking about? All right, he's concerned about the lost. He's thinking about the people who are not just lost. He's thinking about the lost in this sense who are, yeah, the wicked, the people who are putting him to death. Now, that's true love, isn't it? You know, you've got this guy that's killing you, chopping off your finger, chopping off your head, and you're interested in his salvation. That puts you in a pretty distinctive category, doesn't it? That's not how the world typically thinks. And yet Jesus, in spite of all that pain, and there had to be a lot of pain, he loves not just the unjust. He loves people who are involved in the most heinous type of wickedness and acknowledges that from the cross. Number two, John 19, verses 26 and 27.
When Jesus then saw his mother, the disciple whom he had loved, standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son."
Okay. I didn't shut you off, did I?
Well, you got 27, though.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household.
Okay, Luke 23:34. Steve, from what he read, Jesus loves the people who are about as vile as they can be. Now, over here, especially in John 19:26, we find that Jesus, as far as his love, also directed that to whom? All right, and you would think in most cases, a person, when it comes to mom, lover or hater. Most of the time, I mean, there can be some issues, but generally a person is going to be thought of as loving mom. And in this particular case, the Lord can't do much, if you will. I mean, he's focused on some other things at this point. But he can at least direct someone. We believe that that refers to John. He can direct John to, you know, caring for mom. So when we think about Jesus, the cross, love is literally flowing from the cross. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at passage 3? You know, somebody might want to, if they wanted to play devil's argument, say, well, you know, the kids probably could have taken care of her, you know, maybe to some degree. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, but if you're a single lady, even today, with the resources that ladies have, you know, that is one of the things that bugs us about our parents a little bit. Dad's gone. Mom's by herself. Teresa's parents, they're both still alive, but they're at an age where health-wise and some other things, you know, things are not good. So, we've tried to, you know, let some other people, you know, take care of some of those things and trust the care to some others that are apparently responsible, those kinds of things. But it does become an issue because kids can't always do as much for the parents as they might like.
Well, and Jesus had half-brothers and sisters, but or at least brothers. But was anybody else following him at that time? And
yeah.
So he knew John would watch out for her spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she needed that. There may have been some physical things that she needed, but especially the other to kind of bring her in that group. So, yes. All right, Luke 23:43.
And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise."
Okay, so first saying, he's concerned about the evil, folks. Second saying, he's concerned about his mom. And now we find some information about repentance. He's concerned about those who are willing to turn to God. I think that's refreshing news. Person today tells us, well, I've done some bad things. I've not lived the kind of life that I should live. I don't know if God is going to love me. Where can we turn? Let's look at the cross of Christ. Who do we find here? We find a transgressor. And this guy is so bad, what are they going to do to him? They're going to kill him. And not just kill him, they're going to put him on a cross. And yet the Lord says to him what? Today, not in 10,000 years, but today, who? You are going to be with me, the Son of God, where?
Paradise.
You think you could impress somebody with that point? That saying on the cross, Just might bail you out sometime in a Bible study with somebody or in a general conversation. All right, number four, Mark 15, verse 34. Let's get a helper for that. Mark 15, verse 34. Brian? After that, we'll look at John 19, verse 28. John 19, verse 28. Who wants to take that? Jenny? And then number six will be John 19, verse 30. John 19, verse 30. Maxine? Okay, number four, Mark 15, verse 34.
At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Okay. When you think about Jesus' agony, yeah, if you go to the doctor, go to the hospital, you've got some pain somewhere. I don't know exactly when they started this. I think it's been around at least 10, 15 years. You get the pain scale, don't you? You know, is it between 1 and 10? Is it between 0 and 10? What's your pain scale? They probably get irritated by the people. Oh, it's 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably not too many times where that happens. But when you think about Jesus, if it was a pain scale, where was it? He busted the thermometer, if you will. Now, again, I think that's interesting when you look at that from the standpoint of the agony on the cross. Anybody ever been in great pain? Real agony? Oh, come on. We're all friends. Oh, okay, at least a few of us have. You know, kidney stones have put me in that category. And I can tell you, Tina's nodding her head, she's had a stone. But if you are in that state of great pain, great agony, you're not typically thinking of somebody else. At least I'm not. I'm thinking about who's got the morphine, you know, and can jab it into my arm and, you know, get me thinking halfway right again. But, you know, here you have Jesus. He's off the chart as far as the pain. He makes that acknowledgement. And yet, in spite of his being in that state, concern for mom, concern for the transgressor that wants to repent, and concern for the people that put him in that state of agony. That's almost unbelievable. And yet, these are the things that you begin to see when you start looking at the cross of Christ and what he said. Number five is going to be John 19, verse 28. Okay. Now, somebody might, as they think about Jesus and the cross, and say, well, look, you know, he was the Son of God. Sure, it hurt, but, you know, he was deity in the flesh. As you look at this passage, as you look at this saying, it reminds us that Jesus was also, he was God, but he also had that human quality. I thirst. So when we think about the difficulties that we go through, we might just say it's just too tough to deal with some of the things. But that was not the Lord's position. He also possessed this humanity. Now mixed in with that, we look at the same chapter, two verses later, John 19, verse 30.
So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit.
Okay. So again, he was deity. Time to go back to God. He committed the spirit to God. And it's just a complete package when you look at the seven sayings on the cross. The last one that we want to take a look at, that seven saying, is found in the book of Luke, Luke 23, verse 46. Anybody want to read that one for us? Luke 23, verse 46. Bonnie?
And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said that, he gave up the ghost.
Okay. He made the point that he trusted in God. In spite of all the bad things that had happened, in spite of all the difficulty, the pain, he affirmed that he did have great faith in God. Then there's this other quick detail that I want to add with just a minute. In John 19, verse 30, again, crosses in the context, this was being discussed, time for Jesus to actually die, and he says, it is finished. Now, the word that's translated finished in John 19, verse 30 is a very interesting word. If you go back and you look at it, sometimes it was used for an artist. The artist has been working on a painting, maybe for a little while, maybe for a long time, maybe it all came together, you know, a short period of time, maybe it took an extended period of time, maybe months, maybe years, and the artist finally puts that last brush stroke on the canvas and he says, it is finished. Same word used by Jesus. There were servants who also used this word. Here's a servant. Master says, go out there and feed the cattle and, you know, shear the sheep and, you know, go out there and get some water and cut the firewood. And, you know, we've got 20 tasks for you today. Servants finally comes in at the end of the day and says, it is finished. Same word, all the work. You have a judge. He hears a case. makes a ruling, and once that sentence is passed, the judge says it is finished. Same word, John 19, verse 30. Word was also used for priests. They would go out and they would offer that sacrifice. And after they finished that sacrifice, once again, they would say, it is finished. A merchant, after someone came in and paid their bill, the merchant would say, it's finished. That is, the bill has been paid. A soldier, after the battle had been fought and won, and the victory had been accomplished, the soldier would say, it is finished. And it was used in some other ways too. But think about that. Jesus is the artist. He's finished the canvas as far as redemption. Jesus is the servant. He's finished the work for redeeming man. Jesus, when we think about the judge, he finished the judgment. He gave us that full and perfect word. He's finished as far as the priest. He's paid the sacrifice. He's the merchant. He's the one who said, I've stamped the bill paid. And of course, he is the one who's the victor. Not everybody recognizes that yet, but he is the one who is in that role. Anything you want to add or ask before we shut it down today? Okay, we do.